Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. And today, as we approach the new year, we'll examine one of the stories we've covered this year, and that is the surprising and deadly emergence of the so-called Islamic State in the heart of the Middle East, as well as the intensifying proxy war in the region between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Two of the leading experts on the area, both of whom speak Arabic and have lived and worked in the region, join us to look back at this year's events and look forward to what might occur in 2015. We'll begin with veteran CIA officer Robert Baer, who is considered one of the foremost authorities on the Middle East, who is currently the National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN and is the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, that was made into the movie Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Robert Baer. His latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Then we will continue our analysis of the events in the Middle East in 2014, as well as try to predict what might unfold in 2015, and speak with Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan, and the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com. His latest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East, and we will discuss whether a generational shift in the region will be able to overcome the growing sectarian divides and the entrenched feudal monarchies and military regimes that have reversed the expectations of the Arab Spring. We will also examine these issues in the broader context of the widening Sunni-Shia divide that is in effect a regional proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And joining us now is Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, the basis for the acclaimed film Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Robert Baer. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and frequently appears on all major news outlets and is currently the National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. His latest book just out is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
It's good to be back.
And just as this year 2014 closes, Robert Baer, what's your sense of the big Middle Eastern story, if we can start with that, of 2014?
I think it's going to continue to boil. We've completely got this. We misunderstand it. At least Washington does. And this is a sectarian war like we've never seen since the 7th century. It's the Shia against the Sunni. We've effectively seen the breakup of Syria and Iraq, and maybe Yemen too. And the question is, it's just going to be very messy before these new borders are delineated. And there's frankly nothing we can do about it. I mean, we can go into Iraq on the side of the Iranians, fight ISIS, which is really the spearhead for Sunni insurgency, but I think we can only make things worse. There may be people in Washington who understand this, but their goal is to go through the motions of doing something, anything. Any number of things could blow up in the Middle East. You could, including Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states. They're not completely stable. It wasn't long ago that we had the murder of an American woman who was stabbed in a bathroom, clearly related to jihadi Islam. You know, will this boil over? That's impossible to tell.
So, but in terms of, I recall Colin Powell's warning to George W. Bush before going into Iraq, he used the pottery barn analogy, if you break it, you own it. Now, we sort of did, drive by liberation in Iraq. We liberated the country and then immediately it turned into sectarian strife and bloodshed and an insurrection that still persists, and now it's even gotten worse. So can you blame the Bush-Cheney regime for opening this Pandora's box, or would it have opened on its own?
I think absolutely. 2003... the Middle East was sort of the status quo, which was showed no signs of changing at all. And our invasion upset a very delicate balance in Iraq. I think we're almost solely responsible for it, before we entered 2003, Al-Qaeda, jihadi Islam, Salafi Islam, whatever you want to call it, just it didn't exist. So we created that problem. I think we, and of course it spilled over into Syria, and, you know, this whole idea of overthrowing a dictator like Saddam Hussein encouraged the same sort of insurrections across the Middle East, from Tunisia to Egypt to Libya and the rest of it. And, I mean, there's no way to know this precisely, but what we've done is just push chaos along and encouraged it. You know, and it's got to run its course. And like I said, I just don't know when that's how long that course is going to go.
But there's no sort of genius hidden plan in the neocon strategy book, which, you know, almost sounds like an oxymoron. In other words, that you bring about this Shia Sunni war, and you know, you just sit on the catbird seat on the sideline as they duke it out. I mean.
Well, I think the neocons are true believers, and like any true believers, they don't let facts get in the way of their beliefs. And I think they really thought that if they could, you know, get rid of Saddam Hussein, democracy would follow, and, you know, free enterprise and the rest of it, that whole religion, and that eventually all these countries would reconcile with Israel and everybody would live happily ever after. You know, these same neocons still don't deal in fact. I mean, they've denied history. You know, that's how far they go. No, they didn't have a plan. They didn't expect this. You know, we didn't get any oil contracts out of Iraq, and we won't get any. The Iranians are, in essence, control that country. That's the parts that aren't controlled by the Kurds and the Sunnis. And I don't think that was ever their plan, but that's what they got. And not that they're ever going to admit it. But look at it this way, and this administration is no better. It's these drone strikes. We have no idea who they're killing. So many of them are signature strikes. It's clearly, look from the Pakistani point of view, not helping things with this attack on Peshawar, where 148 people were killed, mostly children. You know, you look at the architecture, I mean, at the archaeology of this, and the two predecessors of Pakistani Taliban were both killed by drones, U.S. drones. So what we did was decapitate the sort of rational leadership of the Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, in as much as they're rational, and we get this guy, Mullah Radio, who went in there and massacred these children. We're getting something worse. We are not sparing lives. We're adding more to the chaos. And, you know, are the drones going to continue? You know, I can't tell you. It's just, they seem to go over well with the American population. It goes over well with the neocons and the hawks and the Democratic Party as well. So, you know, but, is there any progress on the ground of settling this conflict? No.
And again, we're speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history. He's the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal and is the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, the basis for the acclaimed film Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Robert Baer. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book just out is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. And as the year 2014 closes, we are looking back at the events in the Middle East in 2014 and looking ahead to what might happen in 2015. So I had heard a number of people from the CIA and other State Department and other experts on the Middle East who have sort of rather wryly said that after 9/11, we went after the wrong people, Afghanistan and Iraq. We should have gone after Saudi Arabia and Pakistan to the extent that they are both, at least in certainly in Saudi Arabia, aren't they creating the ideology, the religious ideology that underpins the kind of brutality that you just talked about that happened in the military school in Peshawar? In other words, without the belief system, would these people be as violent and destructive as they are without drones being the straw that broke the camel's back?
I think you can lay this, at the feet of the Saudis Wahhabi Islam is jihadi Islam. It proselytizes violence against the West. It's a very insular sect. I think it's a cult, the Wahhabis. They're unforgiving, and they export it to Pakistan. And the Pakistanis went along with it because they thought they could use it as a club to beat the Indians over the head. And then the Pakistanis led it into Afghanistan. So they certainly encouraged this. I mean, I don't think anybody had any doubts that this would come back and, bite them on the posterior. I think that's, but it's not the way they looked at it. They looked at it as their immediate policy interests. The Saudi royal family encouraged this, and especially the exporting of violence and jihad, simply to turn these people's attention away from a corrupt regime. And yes, we did go to war against the wrong country. Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11, as much as the neocons tried to convince us they did. There's no evidence for it. And, getting rid of these secular dictators in the Middle East may make us feel good for a while, but at the end of the day, if you're an Iraqi and you've had your family wiped out and your village and your town, and you're living with car bombs every day, and you have ISIS is sort of your alternative, I think you're worse off than under Saddam. I mean, just the sheer numbers. So we did go after the wrong enemy, and we've ended up in the camp of an enemy who no one wanted to be there. I mean, the Israelis are, apoplectic about this, that our virtual alliance with Iran in the Middle East, and they really do have problems, the Israelis, by the way, on their border. If you just look at the terrain around them, and they've got a lot of crazy people. And if Jordan should go under, and it's not impossible, it's even going to be worse. So, we look back at it, 2003 was probably the most disastrous voluntary military campaign in modern history.
Well, but the Jordanians, for example, have put forth this planned for Palestinian statehood to the UN Security Council, and the U.S. is, Netanyahu has been pressuring the U.S. to veto it. The French may join in. The Security Council may not have the 9 votes yet, but Malaysia and Venezuela will be joining in January. So it's an expectation that there will be a resolution before the Security Council on a 2-year fast track for Palestinian statehood and for the Israelis to withdraw from the West Bank. So when you say that the Jordanian regime may not last, it seems to me that the Jordanian regime are trying to tell the Israelis that you got to do something about the Palestinians, because don't they have 60% of their population Palestinian?
They do. The demographics are against Israel. I mean, they can't absorb the Arabs, whether Muslim or Christian, because they'll just be overwhelmed demographically. So they are living on a fuse. And then the Israeli politics are so complicated. There are truly people there that believe that the West Bank was given to them.
By God, you mean?
Yeah, by God. And the UN or the United States or anybody else is not going to change that. I spent enough time in the West Bank in those settlements. Those people are true believers in the full sense of the word. And the Likud has to listen to them. And, what's going to happen when these contradictions are really put under serious political pressure, like chaos in their borders? That's another thing that I just refuse to even try to predict. But it's not good. I think nothing's going to blow up, this coming year. But 3 or 4 years from now, I think it's just the pressures for the Middle East. How could we avoid a serious regional war? And these regimes in the Gulf are just horribly corrupt. And, some world economic downturn where oil is driven down to, $10 or $20 a barrel for the long term is going to have a great effect on them, and a poisonous effect, I should say. Mm.
Well, conversely,
are we going to go in? Yeah, no, Kissinger said we should go in, and if things got bad, and seize the oil field. that might not be a bad idea if the whole place blows up. But, you know,
he said that in 1975, because I remember talking to James Aiken, the ambassador at the time, and the Saudis were apoplectic, and he said, you know, the U.S. is planning to seize the airfields, and what's going on here? And Aiken said, oh, no, it's not happening. And then he checked with Washington, and sure enough, it was Henry Kissinger that they were seriously planning on just seizing the oil fields. Of course, you know, already you mentioned Saudi Arabia's days may be numbered. They have some problems in that area where the oil fields are. With the Shia majority, they've been executing a number of people. But just to finish up on the Palestinian issue, though, because I wanted to obviously talk to you about Saudi Arabia and these vulnerable Gulf states. The conventional wisdom is that if the Israelis settle the Palestinian problem, a lot of these other pressures will go away. Do you buy that?
No, we're too far down the road. There's been too much bloodshed, and we're just going to have to see it through. The quicker we divide up the Middle East and redraw the lines, the Sykes-Picot borders, the better off we're all going to be, even if it means moving populations. You know, the Palestinians are not coming back to Syria, for instance. They all got up and left, mostly. The Alawites, the minority regime, is not going to ever live with the Sunnis. I don't know what those borders are going to look like. And the Palestinians, you know, if things got bad enough in the West Bank, there's the old, you know, saw that they're going to move to Jordan and they're going to create a Palestinian state there, which is always a possibility. But again, you're going to this. It's all uncharted waters, you know.
Mm. Go ahead.
Yeah, if you would tell me that Iraq was going to split up into three countries and Syria into two, 10 years ago, I wouldn't have believed it. But you know, it's happened,
mm-hmm.
and a lot worse can happen still.
Just to finish up on Israel, though, my sense is, just in terms of you're talking about how the neighborhood is getting more dangerous for the Israelis, my understanding is that the Sinai is a total no man's land and is an incredibly dangerous area, and that the Egyptian military don't have control of it, and that they also may well face an insurrection because of their suppression of the Muslim Brotherhood.
You know, that's another good question. That's another country. Is it going to go under as Egypt? And you're right, the Sinai is not under anybody's control. You've got the jihadists are shooting down Egyptian helicopters. I mean, they can't fly in large parts of it. And that's right on Israel's border. And these people, their view of end times and the rest of it, are perfectly capable of firing rockets into Israel and starting a war they can't win, but a very destructive war for Israel. So, you know, if this were to coincide with a third intifada with the Palestinians, you'd have an Israel on the edge.
So, Robert Barry, let's move then back to Saudi Arabia, where you mentioned earlier that you thought it was not entirely stable and that these Gulf regimes aren't going to last over the long haul because they're so corrupt. I mean, the overriding aspect of this area, though, surely, is the Saudi-Iranian competition. And there seems to be some movement towards the rapprochement between Iran and the West and Iran and the U.S. Is there a possible strategic realignment? Because remember, our whole policy in the Middle East back in the 60s, 50s and 60s was based upon Iran being the fulcrum, if you will, of U.S. policy. And then we shifted to Saudi Arabia, and they've been incredibly duplicitous while, you know, maybe they're helping us out now by dumping the price of oil down or dumping oil on the market, and it's hurting Russia and it's hurting Iran and it's hurting Venezuela. But over the long haul, many people argue that we would have been better off making a deal with the Shia all along.
Well, you know, Ian, as you know, I wrote a book about this, The Devil We Know. I said that the Sunni world is going to fray and come apart, and we'd have no choice but to deal with Iran because it's a country of 70 million people stable within its borders And they are clearly in their thermidor. I mean, they're so crazies in Tehran, and it's still an Islamic state, but they are no longer exporting terrorism. In fact, in a place like Iraq, they're bringing a certain amount of stability, and they've been very restrained in places like Bahrain or the Eastern Province in Saudi Arabia, which is Shia. Even in Yemen, if they're doing anything, it's not disruptive, and they are starting to make sense. And Rouhani, the president, we used to be a radical militant, and he's toned down a lot. So I think yes, there is going to be a realignment, and it's going to depend on what's going to happen in the Gulf states. If they should come apart, and you know, I've been talking about this for years, and they haven't, and people don't believe that they will. But if they should, we will have no other allies in the Middle East except Iran, and that's it. And you know, even Iran is closer to us than Turkey, because Erdogan, you know, he's clearly a Muslim brother. I mean, I don't know how else to describe him in his supporting groups like ISIS. So, you know, by default, we've got Iran, and if it all comes apart, we don't have any choice. And you know, fortunately, I think that Iran is moderating itself to a degree that we can learn to live with it.
Well, if we could make a deal with Iran, it would make a huge difference in Afghanistan. Assuming that Afghanistan is not lost, the New York Times just a week ago reported that all the areas that the U.S. have evacuated, Helmand, etc., the Afghan army is just getting absolutely whipped by the Taliban, who are quickly taking over all that territory. But there is this highway built from the Indian Ocean all the way up to Herat that goes through Iran, and it would be the only, and of course we've had a terrible time supplying Afghanistan and being gouged by the Pakistanis, and the tons of equipment have to be left behind, etc., or shipped through Russia at great expense, so, or the former Russian stands, etc. So there is some talk about that. There's some talk about India also helping out as well, but of course that would just make the Pakistanis crazy. My sense, just in closing, Robert Baer, is that that's the scariest country of all, Pakistan, a huge and growing nuclear arsenal with a state-sponsored terrorism under a nuclear umbrella.
Well, and then let's don't ever forget Abbottabad. The Osama bin Laden had taken refuge inside of a Pakistani garrison town. And Pakistan is a police state. This isn't like moving to, you know, New York City and, you know, getting on Craigslist and finding a roommate and just moving in. It doesn't work that way. Somebody there knew, as Secretary of Defense Gates said at the time, somebody knew he was there. And the question is, we don't know who's in charge in Pakistan. We don't know if there's somebody, you know, that's lost his mind, is going to take that country over and their nuclear weapons. And it'll happen. We'll wake up one morning, it will have happened. I'm most scared of Pakistan, of actually going over, under, and getting in some sort of nuclear exchange with India. It's not beyond the realm of possibility.
Well, Robert Baer, a grim note to end 2014 on and look ahead to 2015, but I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, who's one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, the basis for the acclaimed film Syriana, which earns George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Baer. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. His latest book just out is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking further about events in the Middle East in 2014, as well as what might happen in 2015.
Oh, no. Oh, well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Yes, war no more. Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more.
my hymn book down by the riverside, down by the
riverside. اكتب واخط بالقلم بالقلم اكتب واخط بالقلم دموع من عيني دموع من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي واسيني.
Welcome back, I'm Ian Masters. And joining us now is Juan Kohler, Professor of Modern Middle East and South Asian History at the University of Michigan and President of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com. And his books include Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Engaging the Muslim World, and his latest, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing on this New Year's, Juan Kohler.
Thank you, Ian.
And given that we're looking past back at 2014 and ahead to 2015, let's focus on the foreign policy challenges ahead in 2015. And at the end of the year, of course, there is, I think, some kind of critical mass developing in Europe. The Jordanians tried to get this proposal before the United Nations Security Council on a deadline for the Israelis to get out of Palestine, a two-year deadline. The French have picked it up. Even if they can't get the 9 votes on the Security Council to get it tabled, Malaysia and Venezuela will be joining the Security Council in January. So it's not going to go away. And the impression I get now is that the Europeans are very frustrated with Israel's intransigence and that it's going to be more and more difficult for the U.S. to continually veto resolutions at the UN. So is there any possibility in 2015 that there's going to be any kind of a breakthrough in terms of this Gordian knot, the Israeli-Palestine question?
Yes, I think things could move rather rapidly on the Palestinian-Israeli front in 2015. As you say, the kind of con game that the Israeli right wing has been pulling on the world of pretending to have a peace process, pretending to support a two-state solution. You know, the scales have fallen from the world's eyes. Almost nobody believes that any longer. It seems clear that the Israeli right wing wants to colonize the West Bank and usurp it altogether if they can. The only thing that stands in their way, really, is they haven't figured out how to take the land without getting the people as well, whom they don't want. They don't want to give the Palestinians citizenship in Israel. The Palestinians have no state. They are stateless people. And Warren Berger once defined citizenship as the right to have rights. So the Palestinians, as stateless, have no right to have rights. And that situation is not going to be acceptable to the international community. And so you're starting to see European parliaments vote to recognize Palestine, and there's real movement. The big possibility for movement is internal to Israel, which is we have to see who will win the parliamentary elections likely in March. If it's the alliance that has been made between what has now become the center right of Tzipi Livni and the Labor Party on the center left, if that alliance comes to power, then very likely a deal could be made. Tzipi Livni is deeply committed to a two-state solution, not necessarily for the noblest of reasons. But she has no illusions. She's got a Mossad background. And from a Likud aristocracy, she's from a right-wing family, but she and her mentor, Ariel Sharon, made this U-turn in the early zeros because they looked at the demographics and they said, well, if we go on trying to annex the West Bank, we're likely to end up with 2.5 million Palestinian citizens, which will completely change the character of the Israeli state. And that's unacceptable to her. And if avoiding that meant making a few hundred thousand Israelis move house, well, nice apartments could be made for them in Tel Aviv. One time they asked Zippy, they said, wouldn't it cause violence if you tried to move the settlers from the West Bank? And she said, that is what the police are there for.
Well, there's no question, though, that Israel, its political center of gravity has moved to the right. And Clinton, former President Bill Clinton, got in a lot of trouble by pointing out that the influx of Russian emigres has moved the politics to the right. And I think most of the historical halcyon vision of Israel as the kibbutz socialist society is a long dead myth. But my sense is that there's some really scary prospects on the right, and Naftali Bennett is the embodiment of that combination of right-wing ideology and religious fundamentalism. Because a lot of the fundamentalists and the Orthodox in Israel are not Zionists, but that's changing with Naftali Bennett. So if you merge the Jewish fundamentalism with Jewish nationalism or Zionism, then you've got a really toxic mix, and that seems to be something that to look out for.
Well, every society has some extremists. There are right-wing movements in virtually every European country, and some of them are becoming quite powerful, as in Greece. The Conservative Party in England and in the UK has recently been losing to UKIP. Those right-wing currents exist in Israel as they exist elsewhere. I think they only amount to something because the United States runs interference for them. So there's virtually nothing that the right wing in Israel could do from a position of power when they are in government that the U.S. wouldn't support. I mean, it might verbally distance itself, but when it came to a U.N. resolution, for instance, the U.S. would veto it. So the U.S. is an enabler of the worst instincts in Israeli politics, and they know that. They say the U.S. can be handled, and they expect to be able to depend on U.S. support for almost anything that they did. That's the real peculiarity here. It's not that Israel has some objectionable groups, and they're not actually, don't represent the majority of Israelis. Only 8% of Israelis are ultra-Orthodox. And as you say, most ultra-Orthodox are not even militant in the political sense. They don't serve in the army or they didn't want to.
And some of them don't believe in the state of Israel.
Yeah, many of them are not Zionists. A lot of them say that they would be perfectly happy to live in the West Bank and take Palestinian citizenship. They don't believe that Israel should exist until the Messiah comes. I don't know. I'm not as alarmed by Naftali Bennett being, representative or popular as I am that he just, structurally speaking, is inserted into a position of great influence. But of course, if Labor and Zippy Livni's party win, then Bennett will be out. By the way, the other thing that works against the extremists among the ultra-Orthodox is that the Russians really, really dislike religion.
Yes,
and so some of them are very far right-wing in a political sense, but they're militantly secular. So I really would not want to have to sit between Avigdor Lieberman and Naftali Bennett at a meeting. I'd be afraid of being black and blue because they would be trying to get at each other through me,
right.
because Lieberman is very militantly anti-religious. So some of those tendencies in Israeli society are offset by other tendencies.
Sure. So in this new year, look forward to 2015 in terms of the foreign policy landscape. You just mentioned some of these right-wing parties like the right-wing anti-Europe party in England that's growing in strength, Nigel Farage's party. One of the most amazing things that's going on, though, Juan, is that guess who's funding Jobbik and who's also funding the National Front, the Le Pen, Marine Le Pen in France? Vladimir Putin. He's funding a lot of these right-wing fascist governments in Europe. And now in the European Parliament, I think they're up to about 20%, aren't they?
Yes. The right wing did well in the last parliamentary elections in Europe.
Do you think that's a growing trend that we should be concerned or even alarmed about?
Oh, sure. I mean, many of these people have, fascist tendencies. And it's very disturbing that, again, on European soil, these anti-immigrant, anti-progressive forces should have a powerful voice. They're by no means the majority, but they're significant and they're growing. The problems are big structural ones, and I think a failure of political leadership to explain to people what's going on or to frame it properly. And there's a tendency among politicians just to ride a wave and take advantage of it. So we've seen the Gaullists in France start to talk like the Le Pen far right in order to attract those votes. But then that legitimizes that discourse. But the Gaullist party, I think, and Nicolas Sarkozy, the former president, bear a lot of blame for starting to make Marine Le Pen, you know, respectable in French political discourse. Things are now being said in the French parliament and reported in French newspapers that would have been beyond the pale even 10 years ago. So it's opportunism to some extent. But the fact is that demographically, most European populations are declining. And so we expect Germany over the next 50 years to go from 82 million to 60 million. And we don't have a really good idea of what that looks like when a country undergoes such a transformation. You'd have a lot of little old retired Germans, not very much, many young Germans paying into Social Security and so forth. Could be wrenching socially.
But there was just a demonstration a week or so ago in Dresden of Germans demonstrating against immigrants from the Middle East.
Well, I'm saying the only way for Germany to avoid this fate of becoming, you know, the incredible shrinking Germany and maybe losing a lot of its economic power would be to replace the population through immigration. It seems very unlikely the German middle classes can be impelled to go back to having large families. But what I'm saying is that somebody in German politics needs to tell the people in Dresden, do you like the idea of retiring with Social Security and health benefits? Well, it's these immigrants that you're protesting against who are going to pay for that. So you should be grateful that they're willing to come and work. And I don't hear, you know, Angela Merkel or anybody important in German politics being brave enough just to come out and give that message and to frame the immigrants not as a social integration problem that, you know, can they be proper Germans, which is how the right would frame it, but rather as an economic asset that can Germany continue to be the world's fourth largest economy? Can it continue to be among the most stable and trusted economies in the world over the next 30 and 40 years? And how would you get to that given the extreme demographic contraction that's going to occur? And, you know, the French, on the other hand, are much better on immigration issues, at least at the governmental level, and have a commitment to it. And we think that France may go from some 62 million to 80 million. That is to say, 30, 40 years down the road, the really dynamic economy and society in Europe may be France and not Germany.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and resume the conversation in studio with Juan Cole.
Going to account for these sins. And I don't
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and we're continuing the conversation here in the studio with Juan Cole. Let's turn to the area of your expertise, and in this New Year's review of not so much looking back on 2014, but looking ahead to 2015, in terms of the challenges in foreign policy, in terms of the Iraq and Iran and Saudi Arabia, it's pretty clear that there is has been for some time a kind of proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. That's the subtext, if not even more overt, in terms of what's happening in the region. And now you have the Iranian leader complaining, didn't mention the Saudis, but basically saying the Saudis are behind the collapsing oil prices, which are having terrible effect on Iran's ability to meet its budget and its outlays, and its economy is already under great stress. So that, do you think that the Saudis can continue to resist OPEC's pressure to raise the price? I mean, how much longer? Obviously, it's hardly a coincidence that the countries that the United States have problems with, Russia, Venezuela, and Iran, are all suffering at the moment. You can't help feeling that somebody is talking from the United States, is whispering in the Saudi king's ear, and he's listening.
Well, but also North Dakota and Texas and Oklahoma bringing on are suffering as well. It's a double-edged sword for the United States, low petroleum prices. Ian, petroleum prices are important. They're not an end-all or a be-all. The energy sector in the United States, I think, is 6% of outlay. So it's not, you know, it doesn't make or break the economy. For oil prices to go up or down a little bit. But we're probably in for a period of lower petroleum prices. This is mainly driven by a fall in Asian demand. The Chinese have been growing 9 and 10% a year. They'll likely grow only 7% this year, and could be 6. And so they just, you don't have as many trucks on the road. And, you know, there's this amazing statistic that the Chinese used as much cement in the last 3.5 years as the United States used in the whole 20th century. Mm. I think we sometimes don't realize what a massive economy is being built out there in China. And it has become the world's second largest oil importer after the United States. So if it's slowing, then you just don't have as much oil being used. And this slowing also is true in Japan, where Abenomics suffered a reversal, and so forth. So the main thing driving these lower prices is lower Asian demand. And that's temporary. You know, if the Indians woke up tomorrow and decided, I'm tired of riding a bike, and they all wanted to go out and get cars, they'd run through all the petroleum in the world, you know, in 5 years. I mean, it just would be game over. There are over a billion of them. And so in the long term, or in the medium term, demand is likely to recover. And since they're not making more oil, and since fracked oil is actually a fairly small addition to the total pool, the secular pressure on prices will be upward over the next decade. But we're in for a brief duration during which the prices will be lower. That is a problem for oil-producing states, Russia and Saudi Arabia, Iran, Venezuela, and so forth, because they have made their economic plans, their budgets, and their projects over the next 10 years based on an expectation of relatively high prices of $100 a barrel or so of Brent crude, and now it's going to be much lower. And so the income is just not going to be there. Saudi Arabia suffers less than the other countries in OPEC because it has such a small population and such large petroleum reserves. So it has a population of something like 23 million. It produces nearly 10 million barrels a day out of the 90 million barrels a day or so that are produced in the world. It doesn't have to do that. The Saudis would be rich if it produced 5 million barrels a day. So it's a swing producer. And what's being said when people accuse Saudi Arabia of keeping the price low is that the Saudis are declining to reduce their production. mm-hmm. Which would have, you know, a marginal effect on the price, or of allowing OPEC as an organization, which is responsible for about 30 million of the 90 million barrels a day. If OPEC created quotas and reduced production in general, if they took a couple million barrels a day off the market, then the price would start going back up. And the Saudis pressured them not to do that. Why exactly the Saudis are happier with a $60 barrel of petroleum is not entirely clear. As I said, it doesn't hurt them that much since their production costs are very low. It costs them between $2 and $10 a barrel to get the stuff out. So 60 is fine for them. But it may be that they are hoping to damage investment in oil hydraulic fracturing and so, you know, make a long-term impact on their rivals. And it may be also that they're punishing Russia and Iran for opposing them on Syrian policy. Obviously, there's some combination of economic and political goods that the Saudis are deriving from not intervening against the lower prices.
But do you see a Saudi-Iranian proxy war as a subtext?
Yes. Well, that's one of the subtexts. But yeah. For the petroleum policy, it's only one
sure.
subtext.
So in terms of then looking forward, it seems that nothing good's going to come from Iraq. That's the can's going to be kicked down the road.
In 2015, the Pentagon is saying that sometime this spring that they would like to try to organize the Iraqi army to go up on a campaign into Nineveh province and try to take back Mosul. As you say, this seems very high concept. And given that the Iraqi army ran away from Mosul not so long ago, last summer, to get them to stand on their ground and fight and be organized enough to go up and take the city, that's a tall order. But that's the announced plan, at least. And it's very problematic because the Iraqi army is largely Shiite. It's serving a largely Shiite government in Baghdad. Mosul is largely Sunni. And if you have a Shiite army conquering a Sunni city, by the way, Mosul is a city of some 2 million, or it was before Daesh took it. It's probably down to more like a million two. It's a major city, and it could well suffer massive destruction and displacement of people in the course of this campaign. And General David Petraeus wrote an op-ed in which he warned President Obama that you don't want to look as though you were the close air support for a Shiite army attacking a Sunni city like that. The Iraqi government and the U.S. government are hoping they can avoid these very bad optics by organizing what they're calling a provincial national guard, sort of Nineveh Sunnis who would be willing to kind of take the lead, and they'd be the force that went into Mosul and so forth. But we haven't seen good evidence of very large numbers of Sunni Arabs signing up for this national guard. And the whole thing seems to me a little bit of a fantasy. So there are big plans for 2015. The proof will be in the pudding, and so far it hasn't materialized.
Well, just finally, let's look at the other foreign policy quagmire that the U.S. has been involved in, this longest war, Afghanistan, pulling out, although there's going to be more residual force left than was originally stated. Already there evidence the Taliban are increasing their attacks, and a lot of people think that once we pull out altogether, there'll be some kind of resumption of a civil war. I'm not sure about that, but it would seem that the Pakistanis, who have always been duplicitous towards the United States and in many ways are responsible for the American and NATO casualties, there seems to be having second thoughts, particularly about reverse sanctuary, where if the Taliban take over in Afghanistan, and they've always, the military ISI have always seemed to be, you know, deeply involved with the Taliban, it seems to be their project, that could create reverse sanctuary for the Pakistan Taliban, who've just recently done these terrible attacks on the school, killing all their school children. So do you think that Pakistan's coming to its senses as the U.S. pulls out? And do you think at some point the U.S. can pull out altogether and maybe just say, you know, let the Chinese take over this mess?
I think that the U.S. Will be in Afghanistan for some time. The original plan put forward by President Obama was that he would do this troop escalation that he pursued in 2010, 2011, do big counterinsurgency. Remember the Marjah campaign and the Kandahar campaign and so forth. And obviously, none of that really worked. But then the idea was to give the trainers time to build up a big Afghan army, some 100,000 men under arms, well-trained, well-equipped, and so forth. And that really hasn't worked out very well either. There are very high desertion rates, and there's real question as to the esprit de corps, the commitment of that army. And what we saw happen in Iraq, where a similar plan had been implemented, was that the newly built up American-backed army sometimes just collapses and runs away. And there is some danger that they'll run away from Kabul and let the Taliban have it. So I think the new president of Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani, is sensible of these dangers and went to Obama and said, well, you know, keep a few thousand more troops around just in case. We need to defend Kabul. So it's probably not to the extent in Afghanistan that the government and the new army can, in fact, impose their will over the entire country, including the Pashtun regions, some of which support the Taliban. Not all Pashtuns do. With regard to Pakistan, there's been a really remarkable sea change in the attitude of the Pakistani elite to these radicals. You know, they have been using them for decades now to make trouble for India and Kashmir. Pakistan maintains Kashmir should be its. India maintains that it should be its. It goes back to the partition of 1947. If you ask the Kashmiris, by the way, they say they want to be independent, but that's probably—
Who's asking them?
Yeah, that nobody's asking them. So as you said, the Pakistani inter-services intelligence and military forces had a policy of supporting the Taliban in Afghanistan because the Taliban are mostly Pashtun. There are large numbers of Pakistani Pashtuns, and so this is a way for Pakistan to influence the politics of Afghanistan, where they view it as their sphere of influence, as their backyard. They're very upset that the northern Afghans, the Tajiks and the Hazaras, have links to India and to Iran. But starting in June, Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif of the Muslim League began a military campaign against the Pakistani Taliban of enormous proportions. There have been lots of sorties flown, bombing raids. There have been firefights. And it's very significant that whereas previous Pakistani governments had done limited operations in South Waziristan against the Mahsud tribe and what's called the Taliban movement of Pakistan, and which had, you know, come into Swat Valley and terrorized people, the Pakistani military had always avoided North Waziristan, which is where the Haqqani group of Jalaluddin Haqqani is based, and then the U.S. has long suspected that the Pakistani military intelligence is hooked up with the Haqqanis, and they've been blowing things up in Kabul and killing U.S. troops. And so the U.S. is, of course, very upset about all this. But Nawaz Sharif has been attacking North Waziristan. It's claimed that they've bombed Haqqani sites, and some of the some of the Taliban from South Waziristan took refuge in the north, and they're being bombed. So the civilian leadership of Pakistan, for reasons that I couldn't tell you exactly, but I think it has to do with the ways in which the Pakistani Taliban have turned on Pakistan and have blown up things in Karachi and Lahore and so forth. The civilian leadership is just not going to put up with this anymore. And so they've decided to take this situation in hand. And apparently, Nawaz Sharif believes that they don't need these radical fundamentalists, who anyway cause a lot of trouble inside Pakistan, in order to pursue an Afghan policy, that there are other ways to do it. And so Nawaz Sharif has much better relations with the new president of Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani, than he had with Ghani's predecessor, Hamid Karzai. And there seems to be this policy shift. So one of the reasons that in mid-December, the Taliban movement attacked that military dependent school, it was for the children of the Pakistani military, was to take revenge on those families for the fact that they're destroying the Pakistani Taliban. And this is a really big story, it seems to me, and we'll see how it works out in 2015, that the Pakistani government has finally come around and is doing the things that the U.S. wished that it had done for the last decade.
Well, Juan Cole, I thank you very much for joining us here for this New Year's look ahead at 2015 in terms of the foreign policy landscape.
Thank you very much, Ian. Best wishes to you for the new year.
Thank you, and the same to you. And again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global American Institute. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com, and his books include Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Engaging the Muslim World, and his latest, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.